For the week of October 12th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 298, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing in Washington, D.C.?
I'm here over the weekend for a wedding.
Really? I did not know that.
It's true.
I didn't know you were going.
I went.
And you're back.
Yes, exactly.
So you went to the wedding, but you're still in Washington, D.C. Our listeners need to know.
That's absolutely.
Can you stop by a friend of mine? He works out of Washington, and he's over there on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Barack, yeah.
Oh, you know him too.
Yeah, keep going. If Barack listens to the show, what will he hear about this week?
Well, on this week's show, we're going to celebrate Columbus Day by delivering all of Showbiz Sandbox in Italian. Buona sera.
Ah, ciao.
And that's actually the extent of my Italian. Pizza, lasagna. Okay, we don't actually speak Italian, but we will cover the world of entertainment. China made news by combating box office fraud, kind of, while Australia made news by setting box office records. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced the 14 acts on the short list for getting into the hall in 2016. I'll make like Johnny Carson and try to read Michael's mind by predicting who he'll be voting for. We'll also dip back into publishing, where despite recent setbacks, many companies are trying to launch the Spotify for Books. I don't know why they're still trying to do this. Given the numbers revealed by Amazon for its Kindle Unlimited program, authors really don't have much to gain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at the worldwide box office brought to you by RentTrak. We also pull info from the LA Times, the Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times, the Variety, you name it. Box office profits, box office mojo. And the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row is The Martian. $95 million over the weekend, $227 million worldwide. It cost $100 million to make. It's going to make lots of money for everybody and maybe even be a factor in the Oscars race. Everybody I know likes the movie. Well, not everybody. I know some cineasts who do not care for it, thought it was kind of boring. But the general public and the general critics and the Academy are crazy about it.
Yeah. I mean, everybody I know who has seen it has loved it. It's been a surprise. I think it's a surprise. Most people, they go in to see a movie these days, you know it's based on something, you've seen something. And I realize The Martian is based on a book. Most people didn't read it. So, you know,
well, it was a very solid success story.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was a self-published book.
It was a breakout self-published book that got picked up by a publisher. I mean, it's a very significant seller.
I know a lot of people who are reading it now.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's not a great book, but it's a great premise. Well, that's it for The Martian. That's number one. Number two around the world is Hotel Transylvania 2, the comeback of Adam Sandler. $43 million over the weekend, $200 million worldwide and counting. Now, here's the bad news. At number three around the world is Pan, the reboot of Peter Pan starring Hugh Jackman, one of the biggest bombs of the year. They say it cost $150 million. That doesn't quite sound right to me.
Well, now, is it a reboot or is it a prequel? So I guess it's a prequel.
It's nothing. It's based on a long stand. It's like Robin Hood. You can't reboot or prequel or something like that. It's just part of the pop culture world. It's part of our, you know, knowledge, you know, Cinderella, all these things, the fairy tales, myths, stories, legends. It's just a new take on Peter Pan, in this case, telling where Peter Pan came from. Well, so it's an origin story, but it's not a reboot of any pre-existing franchise or anything like that. It's just a new movie based on the well-known classic tale of Peter Pan. It cost $150 million to make, they say, and it made $36 million over the weekend. That's opening worldwide in 55 territories, a huge bomb here in North America, a bomb pretty much everywhere it played. It's made $40 million so far in counting, but they're going to be counting very briefly.
Well, and there have been very few times at CinemaCon or Show West where something is shown by a studio on their showreel and it receives a not a tepid response, but a silent response.
Virulent silence.
Where people walk out going, oh my God, did you see that? What were they thinking? Now, the most classic, I would say, is The Hobbit, when they showed the high frame rate and people walked out like stunned.
Utterly bemused. Yeah. Well, that made a lot of money though, didn't it?
Yes. Now, the last time this happened was this year with Pan. They showed footage from this film and it was kind of more than a trailer, but it wasn't the official trailer. And people, just all the exhibitors, the movie theater owners looked at one another and you could read their minds.
Everybody knew for a long time this was a bad movie. The trailer looked bad. The footage shown to the industry looked bad. any early buzz and reviews were bad. But nonetheless, Hollywood Reporter and Variety have to do think pieces like, why did Pan do so poorly? You're like, well, because it was a really bad movie. Yeah. What do you mean, why? And then they're saying, is this the end of origin stories? Will no one tell an origin story again? It's like, no, it just was a bad movie. But I do not believe it cost $150 million.
You think it cost more?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It's a big, big movie. There are no sets. It's all digital. It's all elaborate. Hugh Jackman probably has to get a good payday, so I don't buy it.
Well, he shaved his head, so of course he has to get a big payday.
At number four is Goodbye, Mr. Loser. That's the Chinese comedy, the time-traveling high school movie where a guy goes back in time to try and redo high school. We've heard that story before. We certainly see this as a success. $32 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide and counting. At number five is The Intern, the Nancy Meyer film. $40 million it costs to make. It's made $100 million worldwide, so it's holding very well in North America, expanding into a lot of countries. This is a movie that older audiences will go see, and they don't show up on opening weekend. It's having the legs you would expect if people are happy with what they see. My mom enjoyed it. Her friends enjoyed it. More adults are going to go see the movie. At number six is Inside Out, the Pixar film. Suddenly, it's back high up on the charts. It grossed $22 million over the weekend. Who do we say hello to?
We probably said hello to China.
Ni hao. That's right. With China is in the news again, of course. Like $11 million of that came from China, so it must be playing in some other territories where it had a big opening, but I don't know what that is. But this pushes it over the $800 million mark. It's now $818 million in counting. Maybe it can get to $900 at this rate. We'll have to see where it ends up.
Well, and it just goes to show you, this movie, Inside Out, a Pixar film from Disney, it has been out for a while. We all know that. It's been out since May.
And presumably bootlegged, is that what you mean?
Exactly. That's where I was headed, because even though you could probably buy this movie on the streets of Beijing for $1.
Absolutely. Yeah.
People will still go see it when it's quality and it's presented properly and it's in a nice place with good sound and good picture and the popcorn and good refresh. People will go.
And that's obviously true for every movie, because they're almost all available online in one way or another.
Well, unfortunately.
Certainly by a week or two after it opens, right?
Yes, I don't go looking for them, so I'm going, yes, they are.
Yeah, they are. All right, at number seven is Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. This sequel is falling hard and fast in North America, but they made it for a price, and they made it for the right price, and it's going to be fine financially. Another $21 million over the weekend, $240 million worldwide. Sicario, this is a Oscar hopeful, I guess, a $30 million movie. It made $13 million over the weekend in its second weekend of wide release in North America, and it's in about 60 territories overseas. It's made $43 million in counting, a very solid success story for the people buying this movie. It's Lionsgate, right?
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
So this is going to make everybody money. It got good reviews. They can try for some Oscars, even though I imagine it'll be forgotten by the time Oscar comes around, but you never know. So, you know, happy news for one and all, because this is the movie that Hollywood doesn't like to make anymore, right?
What?
The $30 to $60 million adult film.
Oh, yeah. No, it has to be under two or over 200.
Right. So The Intern and Sicario, one, a very broad mainstream movie, the other, an art house movie in a sense, but both, you know, films that Hollywood wants to run away from, and yet they had a success, along with the Maze Runner, which cost, they say, $60 million to make. So you're seeing a lot of success for movies that are in that spot that Hollywood considers very, very difficult. Of course, it doesn't always work. There is one other movie it sort of worked for is Everest, not making its money in North America, but doing it worldwide. Another $11 million over the weekend. It's at $160 million and counting, so it should be safe. You know, they're going to make their money back. It's not a big success, but it's going to be just fine. On the other hand, there is The Walk. This is the Robert Zemeckis film. It stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, a terrific actor, and it's about Philippe Petit walking between the wires set up at the World Trade Center. A crazy stunt. And here it is, a feature film. It was a complete disaster, even more than Pan, in my mind.
Well, I mean,
it cost a lot less, but the complete Pan at least made $50 million on opening weekend. This movie was ignored in North America. Nobody went to see this movie. It made $8 million over the weekend in 60 territories, 61 territories. They're like, get it out quick. And it's grossed $13 million and counting. It did poorly, very poorly in limited release. It did poorly on its wide release. It's going to be gone and long forgotten pretty soon.
And you want to write a think piece about why something didn't do well. Okay, granted, maybe the movie wasn't good, but
it's not a good movie.
The Walk, I mean, here's a movie that looked on the trailer and the footage shown, and all the way back to the beginning of this year, it looked like it was gearing up for a nice little Oscar run. And,
oh, absolutely. Well, involved, given the people involved in the story and that the documentary, you know, did that win the Oscar, Man on Wire?
I think it did win the Oscar,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, you know, just, I think it did. So, you know, yeah, there's a high pedigree. And, you know, I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I think he's really talented. But, you know, it just was a boring movie for most of it. You know, you watch it, most of it's boring. It's not very interesting, not very well done or interesting. It's far less complex and nuanced than the documentary. They went for a gauzy feel-good movie when, in fact, maybe it should have had the feel of like a, you know, Dog Day Afternoon, gritty New York in the 70s. It's the documentary is kind of a heist film where they're breaking into the World Trade Center. The movie is like this sort of bland biopic, you know, so they sort of went with a completely wrong feel, or at least a feel that didn't work. I thought it was commercial, though. I have to say I was wrong. I saw it at MoMA with a preview audience, and they loved it and they applauded. They don't always applaud, but they applauded. And I thought, oh, this is commercial. And boy, was I wrong. At number 11 is the German comedy, Darn You, Shakespeare. We can't even say its name in English. It's the Goethe comedy. It's a sequel to Darn You, Goethe. And it's just chugging along. $7 million over the weekend, $125 million worldwide. But now it has some competition. Nothing remotely as big gunned as Goethe turned out to be, but it's another German comedy. It's called Er ist wieder da, also known as He's Back. It's a comedy about Hitler, and it's based on a book, just like The Martian, and just like, in a way, The Walk perhaps is optioned by a book. I don't know. I mean, the Maze Runner, there's a lot of books on here. And this is a comedy about Hitler coming back. He just pops up in a parking lot, wakes up, doesn't know what's happened. He can't remember anything since 1945.
Does he have tattoos on him? Because if so, there's a television show that the...
Everyone assumes he's like a method actor or some stand-up comic or something. They think he's just joking. But of course, he's serious, and he starts to record YouTube videos and becomes really popular and then decides to run for office. So it's a black comedy, very successful as a book. Now it's a movie, and it has a nice solid start with $7 million. Unlike Darn You, Goethe, this one might actually travel. We'll have to see. I'm not sure what the reviews are like, but it feels like a movie that could travel overseas, given its high concept.
Well, what's interesting about Goethe is that it's made $125 million in two territories. That's a lot for two territories.
That's a lot, absolutely. That's a huge amount of money. At number 13 is Lost in Hong Kong, the successful third part of a trilogy, if not a quadrilogy or whatever they're going to make. Another $7 million. That's at $240 million. And then one more, there's Chronicles of the Ghostly Tribe, another Chinese film, also making a lot of money. It just passed the $100 million mark. And down at, where is, there's one more other new movie. Number 17 is The Advocate, A Missing Body. It's a Korean drama. Had a pretty soft opening, I'd say. I don't know what the budget is. But it's just a general drama about prosecutors and DAs and people trying to have a trial where there's no body. They want to convict someone of murder, but all they have is a pool of blood. It opened to $3.7 million over the weekend, so not a great success story, I imagine, given South Korea and how strongly some movies can open there. But, you know, if you know differently, let us know.
Well, and they're obviously coming for you, Michael. I hear the police now just around the corner.
Oh, can you hear them in the background?
I can,
well,
yes.
Maybe they're coming. Maybe they're just protecting Disney as they cart all their money from the theater chains to the vaults, to the Scrooge McDuck vaults, because they're making a lot of money this year, aren't they?
That's right. And it's the third year in a row that they have made worldwide over $4 billion at the box office. And it's kind of a milestone that studios like to cross these days, especially on an international level. Fox set the record.
That's probably the only way to set a worldwide box office record is internationally.
Well, yes. That's a good point, actually, when you put it that way. So the most a studio has ever made worldwide, internationally, is $5.5 billion. That was done by Fox in 2014.
And more big movie, Disney. more big movie, and you got another $1 billion.
Yeah, and let's see. What else do they have? I don't know if they can make it to 5.5. What do they have? Star Wars. Yeah, they'll make it. They might not make it to 5.5, but they'll cross the $5 billion mark, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is that the only other movie they have?
Oh.
I mean, that's $1 billion movie, right? I mean,
yeah, but it's being released at the very end of December, so most of its money will come.
You're right. You're right. So it'll only make like $400 million in the last week or two of a... Australia is also doing good at the box office, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. It turns out that they have a big share of, and by big, I mean 6%, of their box office. So films made in Australia for Australians and the world, they've made $46 million. And they're thinking that it will actually approach more like $50 million in Australia by the end of the year, which you think may think, oh, well, that's nothing, you know, but actually it's significant.
What is the total Australian box office for a year, I wonder? You know, if it's 6%, well, we can't work that the numbers don't work that way, but you know, what are they talking about?
I think they're talking about this is me vamping while I look it up by year.
So that would be maybe half a billion dollars.
That makes sense. Actually,
I'm awfully surprised at how low the percentage is, and as a record, because I always think of Australia as having a very healthy local film industry. And so I'm surprised that, you know, with all those great movies that they've had over the years, like Gallipoli, I'm going to be start naming Peter Weir films and Mad Max movies and stuff like that. But I mean, they have a lot of great movies, Gillian Armstrong, but I guess they're great films, but they're not necessarily big blockbuster type films. You know, My Brilliant Career and Gallipoli are lovely movies, Breaker Moran. But I guess they're not huge box office hits. So still, I'm a little surprised. They have such a good industry. So many of their talented directors and actors come to Hollywood and have great success. I would have thought the Australian industry would have a bigger. Is that low for worldwide or?
No, I mean, they make actually here. Thank you, Screen Australia. And pardon me while I look that up. Over $1 billion, $1,074 million.
Well, then
that was 2014.
So them being at 6.8% is their best since 2001. So they're at almost 7% of the total box office, and that's their best that they've ever done in like 15 years. And I guess historically they're below 5%.
Yes, correct.
Wow. So. Most countries are in that position, aren't they? I mean, Peru does not have a big local film industry. Luxembourg does not have a big local film industry. But I would have thought the infrastructure in Australia would have been enough for them to be doing better, to be punching above their weight.
Yeah, no, I would have thought that too, but that is not the case. And it seems like, you know, there are a lot. So I guess 2014 was 26.2, according to Screen Australia, 2.4.
26 million?
26.2 million, yes.
That's what Australian films grossed in Australia.
Correct.
All right. Well, you know, China is certainly punching at its weight, above its weight. It's starting to do what it should do because it's got one of the biggest populations in the world and their box office is on fire. They announced some new initiative, which I thought was interesting, and I think you're going to scoff at a little bit, Sperling. I'll be interested to know why. They are getting serious about combating box office fraud, at least a little more serious, and a step towards transparency. In the second biggest movie market in the world, they have launched a national site for reporting box office in an almost real-time manner. This should help combat fraud and aid in keeping everyone honest. It launched last week. It was part of a secret deal between the MPAA and China. Apparently, China's going to allow outside auditors to come in. I haven't really seen more about that, but I'm interested to know what that means. But the one big initiative is this website. It's overseen by the Film Bureau, specifically the Special Fund Administration. It's the first time official comprehensive ticket sales info has been made available at all. International companies will be allowed to audit China's box office. I don't know how. It's updated every night, and it's not real time. Real time would be preferable. I don't know what that means, but why should we,
Real time,
the jaundiced eye at this? What's going on?
Well, first of all, okay, so let's talk about, work backwards. Real time. Real time would mean... you'd see tickets as they're coming in. It would be like watching a ticker. Yeah.
But do we have that in America? Because I don't know a site to go to where I can see real time tickets spouting up.
Well, you can't. However, the studios have what are called hourlies, and the hourlies, and they're an hour or two behind, but they come from RentTrak, of course, and they are being pulled only from certain circuits. So Regal, AMC, Cinemark. I don't know whether they are providing hourlies, but these big circuits, these big chains can typically provide hourly figures.
So basically I use a credit card at the box office and they bing bing, an hour later the studio gets info that they sold a ticket.
Well, and it's not just one ticket. These are what are called flash grosses. So they're
unaudited. They would collect them all together and say you just grossed, $300,000.
Right. And they can extrapolate from there knowing, okay, well, it's at 50 circuits, 50 chains, and these are the top three, and here's how much.
Do they update the hourlies with my ticket sales in advance or when I'm going to be using the ticket? So if I buy one 2 weeks in advance, they know an hour later that I bought that ticket, right?
I don't know. That's a
or
good
it goes
question.
Towards the totals.
In other words, do they count pre-sales? They count pre-sales the day of, by the way. And that has to do with the point of sale. So meaning the point of sale does not count it as a ticket sold, until that day. Until that business day. Of the time. Now that will, vary system by system and chain by chain, and whether they actually
report. So why didn't China go to real-time data? Do they not have the technical capability yet?
They have technical capability, but it's a very large country. It's huge, as you know.
It's like a continent.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact. And
so is America.
Yes. However, their infrastructure may not, their technical infrastructure may not be able to do that in all areas. Ours isn't.
We're talking about having that in the big cities and the big areas where the 400 million people who are in the middle and upper class are. We're not talking about getting real-time data from a small village out in the, way out in the middle of nowhere. Obviously, a small village, we don't expect it to be hooked up and providing real-time data. But presumably, you could provide real-time data in the big cities where most of the sales are happening.
You could probably do that. However, I would imagine that the exhibitors in China did not want to go this far. So they're certainly not going to want to provide it on an hourly or real-time basis.
So they don't want a lot of American movies. They don't want a lot of they want to keep the money in town. Why did they agree to this? What was the pressure that Hollywood and other countries could provide that forced China to do even this?
Well, right now, they've built all of these multiplexes, and it's great that you have Chinese content to put in them. I mean, it's fantastic that you can have local content. However, you're also going to need the content that is being pushed.
You want Star Wars.
Yes. You want the big movie, big worldwide blockbusters you're going to want, which is why when they kind of upped the international quota, the import quota in China, they said, okay, we'll bring it from, I think it was like what? 15 or 20 or something like right. that to 34. So we'll double it. However, the films that fill in the gap have to be IMAX, 3D, these big movies that will fill all of these multiplexes, which have been built over the last 10 years and continue to be built. So
is this a symbolic gesture, or do we believe it's actually a step towards more transparency and fighting corruption?
I think it is. I'm going to say yes to that. So, in other words,
I asked you, which is it? You
I can't think say it's yes. a symbolic gesture.
Either it's a face-saving gesture, and it's just cosmetic, or it's an actual real step towards.
I think it's a face-saving gesture because it's being discovered, as Patrick von Sikorsky reported in Celluloid Junkie this week, that some of these big films that you hear, these big Chinese films, Monster Hunt, for instance, playing to empty audiences, even though technically it says it's sold out, there's nobody in the audience. So, I think it's a face-saving gesture and symbolic, but it's also a way to begin to try and, if China wants to actually begin to corral the exhibitors into some form of regulation.
But why do I care if it's at 9:30 at night once a day? Are you saying because it's at 9:30 at night once a day, they're going to fake stuff?
Well, it's a lot easier
to do
that.
It's not real time. It is a lot easier? Okay.
Yeah, I mean... It's, if it's only once a day, then you can report what you want to report when you report it.
Okay.
If you report it.
So did Hollywood get hornswoggled?
Time will tell.
No, it won't tell. You have to tell right now.
Well, first off,
offered something that's not that big a deal and they should have, I don't mean to segue into big deal, big whoop. We're not done. We got other stuff. We got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I just mean, did they get a good deal or did they get shafted?
They got a good deal because they got them to do it at all. They needed to get
That's where
done.
China is, genius, right? You're so desperate for them to do something that, like, they do something that's not very meaningful. Look what we did. That's where they really get to lower expectations. So they won.
Well, let's put it this way. And I'm putting my personal bias on this, so I should let you know. It is significant in that regard. They actually did get them to move on this. However, In my experience, in my following this over the last 10 to 15 years, what I've noticed is China will do something such as this, and then again, there are no rules. So just because they've done it doesn't mean it will actually mean anything.
Well, I put you on the spot about China. You put me on the spot for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Okay, well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its nominees for this year. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to name the band or the artist and guess which one you believe will get in. How about that?
Sounds fair.
Okay, so the first one up is The Cars. I think that you're going to say, yes, they will get in.
No, I'm not saying yes, they'll get in. I'm saying, no, I don't think they should get in. I don't think they deserve it. I'm not predicting whether they'll get voted in. I'm telling you what I believe. The Cars do not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's what I believe.
Okay.
Fine band, fine group. couple good songs. I mean, you know, a number of good songs. God bless them, but not Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Do you think they'll actually get in? Even though they don't belong in, do you think?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Then we have, and we're doing this in alphabetical order, Chic. I think, no, you don't think they belong.
I think they do belong.
What the?
Not a huge discography, but wildly influential, and not just in like dance music. I mean, they really influenced new wave and German music and hip hop. I mean, their samplings have gone all over the place, and they're a really important group influentially. A lot of people in a lot of weird different areas talk about Chic, and I think their influence is really what makes them deserve to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I think they will get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Chicago is the next band or artist on the list here. And I'm going to say that despite their popularity, you're going to say no.
No, they do not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. However, they make it in because they know everybody. Everybody's recorded with people from Chicago. I mean, this is one of those bands where everybody's been in and out of. It's like Toto, you know, everybody knows them, you know? So if they get in, it'll be just because everybody knows them. So they may get in by default just because, oh, I got to vote for them.
Okay, the next artist is Cheap Trick, and I'm going to say that, yes, you believe they should get in.
I kind of don't, but I haven't really listened to them. And my friend Sal of NYCD Records, a great now-gone record store, we've had him on the show. He is a huge fan. He believes in them. He loves them. I would say just for that stupid guitar. I hate when those guitars have three necks, you know what I mean?
Yes.
They're stupid. They look like, I'm like, that's so moronic that alone makes me not want to put someone in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But I believe in Sal, and so I'm going to say, yes, they deserve to get in the hall. And I do believe they will get in the hall because I think they are kind of one of those rock acts, big stadium acts that a lot of artists really admire their musicianship and who they are and their longevity of their career, perhaps more than we realize.
The next artist, Deep Purple. This is, I think, the third time they've been nominated. So I'm going to go with yes.
Yes, I think they should be in.
Yes.
No, I don't think they should be in, but they are certainly, if you're going to honor heavy metal, there's just like Led Zeppelin, them, and Black Sabbath, you know? So if anyone's going to get in, it should be, you know, these three guys, and Led Zeppelin, of course, is there. I really could care less about Deep Purple. They haven't gotten in before. I don't think they're going to make it. I think maybe they'll just slip off. It's like one of those, like the Baseball Hall of Fame, where you don't get voted in, and then you've got the committee that can sort of catch them and say, no, they belong. You know, so there's nothing like that for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If they don't get in, I think they'd still have chances down the road, but they may just finally slip off the list altogether.
Janet Jackson, I'm going to go with yes. You do.
Oh,
you believe.
No, she does not belong. Okay. Of all, this is ridiculous. You know, she's one really good album, one hugely popular album. She's a Jackson. She may get in because she's Jackson royalty. I fear she'll get in because she absolutely doesn't belong. I mean, I bode her no ill will. It's just, you know, come on. That is not a Hall of Fame career by any stretch of the imagination.
Now, I wish I could actually provide an answer for this next one, but I have no idea who they are. The JBs.
Are James Brown's backing band in the 70s, from 1970 on to like 78. I may be wrong about the later year, but they were, you know, he had a different backing band with a different name in the 60s when he was, you know, doing some of his great stuff. And he had great funk songs through the 70s. So that is his backing band. Members went on to like be in Parliament Funkadelic, Macheo Parker, if I'm saying his name right, hugely. You know, these guys are sidemen on like 1,000 albums.
So yes or no?
No, I don't believe they belong in the hall. I think they're great sidemen. I think James Brown's records are great. He belongs in the hall. They belong, you know, they're great sidemen. If you had a section for like great sidemen who played on a lot of other people's records, yes. But what they did on their own as a band, because they had albums of their own that they released, is just not that important. Yeah, they have a lot of great guys in it, and they went out and did a lot of great stuff. But their own work, I don't think, even comes close to passing muster. Okay. But again, they're on so many albums, they may slip in.
Okay, well, let's try and plow through some of these other ones so that we don't take too long. Chaka Khan, I'm going to go with no.
Chaka Khan? Chaka Khan?
Yeah.
No. Great voice, not a Hall of Fame career.
Los Lobos, yes.
I say yes, too, though. My friend Sal, we should have had him on the show maybe to debate this. He says no. He doesn't think they quite, he loves them and he'd like to see them in, but he doesn't think they have enough albums and really have a Hall of Fame career. I think they do. And the fact that they represent,
they've been around for like 50 years. I think
they've been around for 35 before, you know, a long time. How Will the Wolves Survive in the early 80s was their first big EP. You know, they're just a terrific band. They're great live. They have three or four great albums like Kiko, and their new album is very, very good. Well worth checking out. So I think they really do belong. And I think as far as representing that strain of Hispanic and Latino music, I think they're a real standard bearer, and I think they're going to get in and they belong.
Steve Miller, yes.
Steve Miller, no. Though he may get in, again, his longevity, I think, really appeals to the members of the Hall, but I don't think he's really got the discography to back it up.
Nine Inch Nails is the next band, and I'm going to say yes, you think they should get in.
I do, and this is one where it's not my personal taste. I have not really paid attention to them. I know Trent Reznor is a great songwriter. Look what Johnny Cash did with Hurt. I know they have important work. I know they've been influential. So even though they're not my cup of tea, I would vote for them. I think they belong, and they will get into the Hall.
Now here we come to, I almost want to skip this one and leave it for last.
Okay, just name them and we'll take them last.
Okay, so I'm going to skip one, and we'll come back to it. The Smiths, then, would be the next one up, and I'm going to say yes.
Slam dunk, no question about it, right. Absolutely. And they will get in first ballot.
The Spinners, no.
Yeah, no. They're a group that was around for decades. They never got any success at Motown. I read up on them because I wanted to make sure I knew what I was talking about, and they were like... Motown had them on tours, whatever, with a bunch of other acts, but they also had to do other work because they weren't important enough. They were like chauffeurs and getting people's dry cleaning, and it sounded like they were sweeping up backstage in the 60s. You're like, oh my God, that's just awful. But the Spinners were like the poor man's, you know, Temptations and Four Tops. But they left, and in the 70s, they signed with a new label, and they had hits. God bless them, but not a great career.
Now, this is a tricky one because the name of the band is Yes. Y-E-S, that's the name of the band. And I'm going to say that, yes, indeed, you think they should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, if you're going to honor progressive rock, where else are you going to start? I think Yes probably does belong. But though, again, this is not reflective of my personal taste, but just standing back and going, you know what? Looking at their impact, looking at those first few key early albums, they probably do belong.
Now, let's backtrack. Remember, we skipped one artist, and it's N.W.A. Of course, we all know about NWA this year because of Straight Outta Compton, which is the kind of origin story of that particular hip-hop rap group. So here we are at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and NWA is a hip-hop rap act.
Oh, well, that's got nothing to do with it. We got disco, pop, soul, okay. R&B, country, funk. You know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame reflects popular music, not just the subgenre of rock and roll. There's nothing more rock and roll than NWA saying... F the police. I did that so you didn't have to bleep it out.
Okay, thank you. And Sasha Freer Jones, writing in the Los Angeles Times, a well-known culture writer, agrees with you, says that NWA does belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, mainly because of what you're describing, Michael, that it is, what? You know, F the police is it's an artifact and it's current.
No. I mean, I disagree with her. She says... there's nothing simple about inducting NWA. The group is as problematic as an act gets. I say, no, it's not. They're a great band with a landmark album. They created a subgenre of popular music, gangster rap. All the members went on to wildly influential solo careers. It's as obvious and clear an issue as there could be. Of course they belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This is not the We Think You're a Good Person award. This is not the You Are a Fine Upstanding Individual award. Phil Spector is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He killed someone. He's in jail for killing someone. Is anybody talking about, you know, removing him from the Hall? Of course not, because we're not saying he's a nice guy. You know, Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, married his child bride cousin and killed a wife, though apparently it was an accident, but his nickname is The Killer. Nobody talks about taking him out of the Hall. NWA belongs in the Hall because they're a great band that's hugely important, and they will, of course, get in on the first ballot. Wagner belongs in the Classical Music Hall of Fame. Again, it's not about the person, it's about the music. Just like baseball is about what you do on the field. It's not, are you a nice guy and do you treat your wife right? Because that's not what this award is about. It's only about the music.
Okay, so that said, Chase Utley. Where do you stand on Chase Utley? And for our international listeners, Google Chase Utley. Google Dodgers, Mets, Chase Utley, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Your suspension? Well deserved.
Okay. And we just gave our listeners homework. And maybe if they need to read a book just to kind of bone up on some of these acts, these bands that we're talking about here, or even the New York Mets or the Los Angeles Dodgers or baseball in general, they may not be familiar with it. Let's face it, not everybody is. You know what? Maybe they can check it out of the library, or they can rent it, or they can, I don't know, subscribe to one of these like all you can drink, all you can eat, all you can read book clubs.
That's right. We talked about last week or 2 weeks ago about a number of them going under and Oyster being purchased by Google, even though they don't really intend to continue Oyster. So everybody wants to create this Spotify for books. And it looks like there was a couple of setbacks, but people are determined. There is now, we've got some information on BookBeat in Sweden, BookMate in Russia, Mofibo in Denmark, and Fabula in Latvia. All of these are ebook subscription companies just launched or still launching or in their beta stages, and everybody's determined to make this work somehow. I don't think Spillane and I can wrap our heads around it, because you just don't need to read 20 books a month.
I wish I could read all you
can eat service doesn't really, it works for movies, it works for TV, it works for music, it works for a lot of things. It works for a gym, which you may want to pretend you're going to go to 4 days a week, even though you don't. But books, most people, you know, a tiny, tiny subset is going to read 2-3 books a week. Most people are going to read 3 or 4 books a year.
I can barely read 3 books a year, 4 books, 5 books, 6 books a year. So you're right. You know,
well, you're right along with most people. I think the average person reads, you know, like there's a whole chunk of 30-40% that don't read a book at all in a year.
That said, I'm reading more. I'm reading more now thanks to the iPad and the Kindle and the reading and the, you know, all these books that I have access to. I am reading more.
Well, that's great. And if I was an author, I would keep my book off all these subscription services, because it didn't do any good for anybody who's on Spotify and Pandora, did it? And you look at Amazon, they have the Kindle Unlimited. They now have this thing where they make a bunch of books available to their readers who are Amazon Prime members. You get to read all you want in the books that they have selected. And there's millions of them, I think, because they have all their self-published books. You sort of have to agree, I think, to be part of this Kindle Unlimited thing. And then they have a fund every month, and they decide how much to put in it, like $15 million or $10 million. And they divvy it up based on who was read the most.
Yeah, it's a usage-based subscription.
Right. So the readers get access to it all, and the authors get paid by a formula Amazon determines with an amount of money that Amazon determines, and that's what they get. So some of the numbers came out, and they're putting more money in, but since there are more authors, it's getting sliced up into smaller and smaller pieces. And it sounds a lot like Spotify, right? In July, authors got paid 0.0015 of a penny per page read. So that means, you know, every page that they read, you got 0.0001 of a penny?
I get
0.01 of a penny? 0.01 thousand, yeah. 0.01 of a penny. So they read a, you know, a couple thousand, maybe you get a nickel, you know. That's down 11% from what they were paying in a few months earlier. So if you had 10,000 pages read, you got paid $51.40.
So let's say I wrote a book, like I read that Kitchens of the Great Midwest. I think it clocked in, let's just say it clocked in at 250 pages.
Okay? Right, it's more than that, but let's just say that.
Okay. And let's say it's a great book, Kitchens of the Great Midwest.
I'm waiting for your review so I can post it on bookfilter.com. That's
true. I do owe you a couple of reviews, actually. Let's say 40 people have read the entire book. They read it cover to cover. They even read the acknowledgments. Okay.
That's right. If 40 people read it, you got $1.25.
Per book.
But then they tell their friends to read it, right? That's the idea, right? They tell their friends to read it. More people read it. It becomes more popular. They can all dip into it for free. So say if they read the entire book beginning to end, you got $1.25.
And you're not talking per person, so it's not 40 times $1.25.
No, it's $1.25 for all those that total reads. 40 people read your entire book, you got $1.25.
So right now, if I'm the author, what I'm doing is I'm calling my publisher, and I'm saying, please take my book off that thing.
Well, let's do the numbers, though. What if 400 people read your book?
Well, it's not going to be much more. So I don't like the whole 40 and $1.25 thing, so I don't like it at that level.
Well, if 400 people read your book, you get $12. If 4,000 people read your book, you get $120. 40,000, you get $1,200. 40,000 copies of a book is a lot for a lot of books. That's pretty great. You know, books are not selling hundreds of thousands of copies. That's a big, big bestseller. But say you do sell, 400,000 people go on to Kindle Unlimited and read your book, you get $12,000. 400,000 people read your book. Typically, if your book is published, you can hope for maybe eventually getting like $1 a book. That's, I think, within the realm of possibility. So if you were lucky enough to have a big bestseller and it sold 400,000 copies, you're going to be one of the best-selling books of the year, and you're going to make $400,000 as opposed to $12,000.
Yeah, so you can see why authors don't like this.
Yeah, and you can see why musicians don't like Spotify. The numbers just don't add up. No matter how successful it becomes, you're just not going to make that much money. So when you add it all up, it's kind of a big whoop.
Oh, I see. You're trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. I get it. Now, our first story is about video games, Zelda and Mario Brothers. Or is it Mario Brothers? I don't know. Either way, they're going on strike, or rather the artists who give voice to all those characters in the video games you play may be going on strike. SAG-AFTRA, you know, the unions that represent the stage and screen actors, they have been unable to come to a new deal after meeting with studios in February and then again in June. So now they called for approval to call a strike, and the actors who actually voted overwhelmingly endorsed giving them that power. So the unions now have the power to strike, with 96% of those who voted saying yes. So now the union will sit down again with the studios and try to work something out, but this time with the looming possibility of a strike to give those negotiations a kind of a certain edge, if you will. One key sticking point? Guess what? Voice actors want more money to kick in on blockbusters that sell 2 million units and then 4 million and 6 million and so on. You know, just like the live actors in movies, let's say, who get more money when a movie hits a certain gross worldwide or nationally. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because it's a big industry. They may foolishly think these voice actors don't matter, but they do. They matter a lot, and they get identified with the roles and the characters and the franchises, and they should be paid accordingly.
Do you know who one of the big voice actors is for video games?
Who?
Big voice actor, Mark Hamill.
Oh, sure. Ice Cube is on, is he on Call of Duty? He's in one of, I watched my nephews in Alabama playing a video game, and I hear Ice Cube going, incoming missiles down, man. I'm like, what? Is that Ice Cube? And they're all imitating Ice Cube. So, you know, NWA lives.
That's true. And so much so they could be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Possibly.
What about the Video Game Hall of Fame?
Oh, I'm sure. Not an NWA, no.
Okay. AMC, the network, is now home to the three shows with the biggest first seasons in basic cable history. The Walking Dead, Better Call Saul, and now Fear the Walking Dead. Yes, the spinoff of the zombie hit proved very popular, averaging 11.2 million viewers when factoring in Live Plus 3, so those are the DVR and VOD viewings. Only Fox's Empire had a bigger first season this year. Better Call Saul averaged 5.9 million viewers. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for AMC, and I think we can officially drop saying factoring in Live Plus 3, because that's the only number we should be talking about. You know, you should only say, well, these are just the overnights and we don't have the final figures yet. That's what people should be saying. So when you say the average 11.2 million viewers, we can assume we mean that this is the biggest number we can find with the most totals, including DVR, VOD, Live Plus 3. And why does it include Live Plus 7? The season ended, so I don't even understand why it's not that.
Well, because of the ads. Right now, advertisers.
But I want to know how many people watched it. I don't care about I'm not taking out an ad. I want to know how many people watched the show.
And generally what you'll see, and by the way, averaging, this, when you hear that word averaging, okay, that's usually, you're right, Michael, it includes the Live Plus 3. Okay, that's
right.
That's why they use that word average.
But also what we didn't get a good track on here was they mentioned how it had a massive debut, of course, and then slid down. But it wasn't clear to me whether it ever plateaued and stabilized. So I don't actually know week to week what it did Live Plus 3. And I don't actually know whether the audience stayed with the show or whether it kept sliding the whole season or not. So I'd love to know whether it, you know, found its level and then it stayed there or what's going on. I tried to figure it out, but I can't.
Well, you know, first, Michael, you got snubbed by the MacArthur Genius Awards.
So again.
Yes, remarkable. And now, I hate to break it to you, the Nobel Prize.
What?
Yes, the good news,
I didn't get the Peace Prize?
No. Yeah, not even some of the other prizes. The good news, as I was about to say, is that the Nobel Prize for Literature made headlines not for picking an obscure or politically motivated choice, but for singling out a journalist Many have called on the Nobel Committee to recognize nonfiction as worthy of praise, and they've done just that by naming Svetlana Alexievich of Belarus as the newest winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. She has an international profile, having won a National Book Award in the United States and top prizes in many other countries for her work that combines oral history, journalism, and literature to document everything from the experience of women soldiers during World War II to survivors of Chernobyl. As a bonus, she's also an ardent critic of Russian Tsar Vladimir Putin. Wait. Anyway. Hopefully that this recognition may help protect Alexievich from the numerous death threats she receives in Belarus, continuing and over the past many years. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's great for nonfiction. It's great for journalism. It's great to have another woman on the list. It's just a terrific choice overall, because sometimes when they make choices that seem political, they're obscure authors, not even that popular, well-known in their own country, you know, and you love to think that they were trying to single them out because they were so brilliantly talented, but too often it feels like just a boring, this is a great choice, on the artistic merits alone. She's really created almost a new genre in her nonfiction reporting. One of those people combining journalism with the literary fiction that we have, you know, it started with In Cold Blood and others, I'm sure, but she has really pushed that forward doing oral histories and combining it. And she's a bestseller here in America.
Well, let
she's
me ask you something. You just said literary fiction. So is literature, when looking at literature and referring to literature, is that not considered fiction? Is it both fiction and nonfiction? I always, when I hear the word literature, I think Ernest Hemingway. I think F. Scott Fitzgerald or Charles Dickens. That's literature. Whereas nonfiction, I don't really consider literature.
That's right. I would say literature to me indicates fiction.
Right, which is why the Nobel Prize for Literature was most often and always given to somebody who wrote fiction.
But it's now more broadly understood as writing.
Okay.
Creative writing.
Right.
You know, maybe that's not the best word, but it's is this literature? Yes, it is art. You know, is a story that you type out who, what, where, when, how, the school board had a meeting? No, but when you write a 10,000 word article and you are creating a work of art, that is literature.
Okay.
And so
just
journalism isn't inherently literature, and literature isn't inherently good or inherently journalism, but they can both have, they cross over, and she's a great example of that.
Amazon is in talks. Yes. Well, that should be enough to put the fear into just about anyone other than Apple. Talks with whom? About what? In this case, Amazon has been in renewed talks for the past few months about bundling TV channels for sale. In other words, they want to do what Apple and Dish and everyone else wants to do, be your cable provider and get you to sign up for a monthly bill in exchange for getting the usual channels, the major networks, and whichever cable content they can wrangle the rights for. They've been down this road before, and now they're going down it again. No word on if a skinny bundle or a fat bundle and will be kind of worked out and what it will cost, assuming you don't just get it for free along with Amazon Prime. I just hope I get it within 2 business days, like all the other Amazon Prime stuff I get. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, right?
Yeah, because
it's
until
very minor talks, nothing happening. Their stock actually took a little hit because people are like, why are they doing that? Everybody's trying to do that. What's their play there? But, you know, if they got serious and did a good thing and had some details and firm commitments, then we can talk.
Carmike Cinemas spent $36 million to acquire the 5-theater, 36 screens of Sundance Cinemas, along with the right to operate them under the Sundance Cinemas name, but not the right to expand that name to new or existing theaters. That takes Carmike to 274 hardtops, as they're known, and a total of just under 3,000 screens in 41 states. Big deal or big whoop?
You should answer this. I feel like it's a big whoop because it's like 36 screens.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not 36. Is it 36 screens?
Yeah.
Oh,
5 theaters, 36 screens.
Yeah. And guess what? It would have cost them $1 million to build each screen. So basically they're expanding through acquisition. The interesting thing here is that they get some theaters in some unique locations, in San Francisco and Los Angeles. The whole idea of keeping the Sundance Cinema's name, what's the point if you can't expand on it?
Right, I don't get that at all.
You're branding something that has a limited market and will always have a limited market. You may as well
have abandoned
it. I bet in 5 years
they'll get rid of it.
Yeah, so it's kind of a big whoop, frankly.
Yeah.
Now, the American Film Institute has bestowed 44 Lifetime Achievement Awards in its history. And now, for the first time, they'll give one to a composer. That would be John Williams, whose legendary partnership with director Steven Spielberg has produced iconic music for everything from Raiders of the Lost Ark to Jaws to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right up to Catch Me If You Can and Schindler's List. Williams also composed one of the most successful scores of all time, namely Star Wars, not to mention the Harry Potter movies, the Christopher Reeve Superman, and countless others. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? I mean, John Williams has like 8,000 awards. He's been nominated for the Oscar 472 times. I think he's only won like four or five, actually. But he's one of the most lauded composers in history. Well-deserved to be so. But I thought, wow, he's the first composer. I wonder if they've ever given it to an editor or a costume designer or a production designer. And no, I went through the list. It's all directors and actors. And then I went, oh, right. The AFI is televised. It's a TV show. And they will never honor all the people who deserve to be honored because they want to have somebody on TV that everyone can recognize.
Correct. And
but that seems wrong because if you're going to have a great production designer, a great editor, you're going to have the actors and directors and the famous people that they worked on their movies. So if you have Thelma Schoonmaker, you're going to have all these great stars and directors that people know. So I think they've got it wrong. That person shows up for 5 minutes at the end, and it's always going to be stars and celebrities promoting their work. So you're being stupid. You can honor costume designers and editors and production designers, and you should.
They call that show, by the way, Michael, the Oscars. Just so you know.
I'm saying the American Film Institute.
Okay. Actually, I saw, The Bridge of Spies. I saw the film.
Oh, yeah? Did you? How was it?
It was good. You know, it was,
How is Mark Rylance?
He is fantastic.
He is a great, great actor. This is a great theater actor. I've seen him many times. I'm literally in love with him. And he's in this movie. And he's going to do Spielberg's BFG. And he's got a great role in this movie. And he's supposed to be just sensational from everything I've heard. It's not a great movie, but it's a good, fun, popular movie, maybe? Is that the idea?
Yeah. I mean, it's a historical drama. So
set during the Cold War about the U-2 spy plane being shot down and a big swap between American spies and Russian spies. And Tom Hanks plays the lawyer representing the Russian spy.
Right.
And he has to negotiate a deal with the commies, right? At the height of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Is it old fashioned to a fault or is it good?
It's good. It's not old fashioned to a fault. It's very good. It's actually a nice little reminder of what those times used to be like and how, you know what? Sometimes building a wall, it doesn't work out so well for you.
And ironically, it's one of the few films that John Williams did not do.
That's why I brought it up in the first place. He didn't do it. And it's noticeable in the film. You're like, this is not a John Williams score.
Exactly. Like Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann. They're linked, joined at the hip.
That is correct. Why come up with a new idea when so many sure things are available to reboot and reimagine? That's the thinking at CBS, at least. They've made a study of dependable crime shows, and they're not going to stop now. First up is a reboot of Nancy Drew from folks behind Grey's Anatomy. This time, Nancy will be in her 30s, living in New York City, and working as a detective for the NYPD. So, what is
it? In other words, it's not Nancy Drew.
It
has nothing to do with Nancy Drew as a teenager who... It's just so stupid. But anyway, keep going.
Maybe it's NYPD Drew.
Oh, very well.
Also in the works is Miss Marple, the famed sleuth created by Agatha Christie, the most popular novelist of all time. For this show, Miss Marple will be young, pretty, American, and the new owner of a bookstore in a small California town where mysteries abound. Doesn't happen at all. Are these projects a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, my God, is this Hollywood to a T? Literally, I saw the Nancy Drew thing, and I thought, oh, my God, that's so stupid. I shared it with people, and we were all like, oh, my, that's not Nancy Drew. And then I saw the headline for Miss Marple. I said, well, they do Miss Marple, obviously. She'll be, like, pretty young and American. And for God's sake, that's exactly what they've done. I mean, Miss Marple is not a young, pretty woman living in California. You're not doing Miss Marple. Like, we'll have Superman. He'll be a janitor working. It's like, no. If you do Miss Marple, you have to do Miss Marple.
And he's got no powers, and he doesn't really come from another planet. He actually he was born here.
These shows could be just fine, but... You're really trading on a name it's pretty stupid.
Netflix just got more expensive. The company's most popular option is the streaming edition, and that just went up $1 to $10 a month for new subscribers in the Americas, and that includes the U.S., Canada, and all of Latin America. It's the second price hike in 2 years in those territories. They have 65 million subscribers worldwide. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because I think they'll be just fine. Some people will scale off, but I think $10 a month is still a great price. People will think it's valuable and it's worth it, and they're going to be fine.
Now, true, kind of a big whoop. I will say this. they're reaching a saturation point. And that is Netflix. They have been growing and growing and growing.
The only way they can make more money is to raise prices.
Correct. So that you will see this time and again. And it will get to a point, and mark my words, where people say, you know, it used to be valuable, but now it's like $20. And I don't want to, mark my words, that is the
only. $20 would be too much.
That is the only way for them to go back to Wall Street.
What they can do is they can scale back on the library that they have. They can say, look, most people only look at like 10% of our stuff.
And they've already started to do that.
You can control costs by, you know, once you've established some hit shows, you don't need to develop 10 new shows every year. If you've got 4 or 5 or 6 ongoing shows, you know, you can scale back a little bit on that, scale back on the library that you have. You know, you're always going to be careful about making sure you have the right balance. But that's, I think, how they'll contain costs in the future. They can't keep raising the price forever, but $10 a month seems like a fair price.
Demo Crazy Networks focus like a laser on who is winning what sliver of the audience. And so NBC has some great news. The Today Show is on a hot streak against Good Morning America on ABC. It's won the first 2 weeks of the season in the key 25 to 54 demo that the morning news shows covet so much. It's been literally years since Today has enjoyed a winning streak of even 2 weeks and follows months of back and forth between the two powerhouses. GMA is still ahead in total viewers, but that gap is narrowing. It's averaging right now, GMA, it's averaging 4.9 million viewers versus Today's 4.5 million. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, I'm surprised that they're having even this success because it takes so long for things to change. And Today was on top for so long that with GMA on top, I thought, well, that's going to be it for a decade. But here they are. It's 4 years later and they're starting to punch.
Woody Allen is going digital. Big deal, big whoop. No, I mean, I should probably finish it.
I think it's interesting.
For his 2016 film project, dubbed ironically WASP 2015, okay, which I think stands for Woody Allen Summer Project. But Allen is working with legendary cinematographer Vittorio Storaro, who I thought was no longer working, so I'm glad to see Storaro is still out there. The man behind Apocalypse Now, Reds, and The Last Emperor, Storaro had seen what Sony's new F65 digital camera and what the lenses were capable of. He spoke to Allen, and this is what he said. I convinced him to record the film in digital so we can begin our journey together in the digital world. He then went out and bought an iPod. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I think. Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't be, but I think seeing like even those old school directors embracing digital, like that's the future.
Yeah, well,
you know,
that's
exactly. Just where it is. And I'm just, you know, you grow up reading Variety and paper, and now it's all online. But like seeing Untitled Woody Allen Fall Project or Untitled Woody Allen Summer Project, that's just like part of the seasonal annual, you know, tradition. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, Untitled Woody Allen film. You know, that's always in production.
That's right.
So it kind of warms my heart. But shooting on digital, why not?
Yeah, the thing about Woody Allen and his annual projects always being untitled, you'd walk around New York City in the fall and you'd always see like, you know, a production somewhere, and you'd always eventually see like, oh, there are the permits. Oh, it's Woody Allen's untitled film. Always.
Yeah.
He never titled them until afterwards. Not sure yep. why. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, I don't know if this will affect everybody. I guess maybe it will. Certainly those of us here in North America who live in big cities and go to shows at clubs or venues that aren't arenas may have purchased tickets from a service called Ticketfly. This is a kind of a Ticketmaster competitor, but only for smaller venues, you know, not for these big, giant, you know, U2 would not be using them to sell out Staples Center. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
And so, you know, when I go to the Troubadour here in Los Angeles, maybe the Beacon Theater in New York, Ticketfly is the vendor who sells the tickets. It's, you know, the software and they're Ticketmaster for small venues. That's what they are.
We got it. And what happened?
Well, Pandora, the online streaming radio station or stations or service, they purchased Ticketfly. Right off the bat, you have to think, wait, what? The radio stations are purchasing a ticketing? Why is that? What, $450 million they just spent on Ticketfly. Why would they possibly do this? Well, when you think about it, Clear Channel was a bunch of radio stations, and they purchased Live Nation, okay? Because it's a way to get in with the artists at the very beginning and to cover everything, not just the concerts and not just the radio play, but everything. They can start licensing, again, 360 degrees.
Okay, so that's what you think. That they need to make more money in other areas. I understood it to be a play to try and give some positive support to the artists. Like, they have terrible relationships with artists and the labels. They're all complaining. They're like, well, maybe we can help you do this. We can help you sell tickets.
Yes.
And you'll be we'll give you more value for being part of the Pandora system. You know, if we can be there and help you get tickets to your fans quicker and more easily, you know, they listen to you. We can meet and say, hey, they got a show in your area and here's some tickets. If we can help power that and make that more, you know, maybe you don't know that they're coming to your area, but with Pandora, you will. And they'll see that value. They'll think better about Pandora and not get so angry about getting paid 0.0004 cents a song play.
That is also true.
Okay. I could not find out if Beacon handles, if Beacon uses, no, it's Ticketmaster.
Okay. Yeah.
That is the typical smaller venue. I've never particularly used Ticketfly. The guy who owns it said, we're worried, but we believe Pandora will support and keep doing what makes Ticketfly special. Is there anything special about Ticketfly, or are they just another service?
Well, what's special about them is they don't charge, you know, these huge exorbitant rates. Well,
that's how they competed.
Right. And they, you know, they were nimble. They were very nimble and were able to help market the artists properly. And people just generally like them because they weren't Ticketmaster.
Well, yeah, that was their biggest selling point, right?
Yeah. And I knew when I said Beacon, I was like, oh, that's probably a Live Nation venue.
Well, we'll have to see where they end up, but it's certainly a significant purchase for Pandora. And if they buy other elements, what would they buy next if they really were wanting to go 360? They have the subscription service. They've bought a ticketing company. What would be the next step?
Well, they have to buy either retail, so the, you know, selling of merchandise and CDs and whatnot, although I can't imagine why they'd want to do that, or they'd have to buy management. They'd have to go out and actually begin to manage artists, which I can't imagine they'd want to do either.
Yeah, they wouldn't want to do direct deals with an artist. It's just way out of their comfort zone.
Well, they might want to do a direct deal for an exclusive period or an exclusive promotion.
No, I don't mean that.
Yeah,
I mean,
no. It's not.
So this is the end of it. You can't see them doing anything else.
Not right
so
now.
It's
not
really 360 then.
Yeah, it's more like a 180.
All right, so that brings us to obituaries. We've sort of scaled back on obituaries, but that's just not do them all. If there's something we can bring to it, maybe we'll do it then. There's obviously important and significant people die all the time that have had great careers. So not talking about them doesn't mean we don't care. But if it's someone we feel a kinship to, or, you know, really hits us hard, we will. And that's certainly the case with Chantal Ackerman, a great director. She died at 65. She apparently took her own life. Her mother had died last year.
Yes, last year.
And her final film, which was playing at the New York Film Festival, was about her interviewing her mother, who was a Holocaust survivor, as her mother was dying, sort of the final period of her life. And obviously it hit her hard, and, you know, now she's killed herself. And so it's a real terrible loss. She's a great, great director, if only for her masterpiece, Jean Dielman, which is just a landmark movie from 1975. It's just a masterpiece. Has influenced so many people, from like Todd Haynes and Sally Potter and Michael Haneke, have all talked about Chantal Ackerman and what an influence she is. Jay Hoberman, who was at the Village Voice once upon a time, he likened her to Godard and the German director Rainer Werner Fassbinder. He says she's, quote, arguably the most important European director of her generation, end quote. And that is not the most important female director, not the most important Belgian director, not the most important avant-garde director, but the most important European director, period.
Gilles Jacob, who for years ran the Cannes Film Festival, actually responded to this to the news of her death on Twitter, saying something to the effect of, she just couldn't stand to live one more second.
Oof.
Like, the way it was written and translated, I just thought, I'm sure he didn't mean it that way, but boy, yeah, did it not come off exactly right.
Well, you know what he meant.
Yes, exactly. And I also knew what Richard Abelow meant, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Richard. He wrote to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He sent us an email. Again, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And I'm combining kind of two emails here. We had a little back and forth because I was trying to figure out, how do we relate this to entertainment? And you'll see what I mean in a moment. Michael, you said you wanted to take this and read,
sure,
this email.
Sure, because it's sort of constructive criticism.
Yes, which we love, by the way. We
absolutely
love, yes.
We love to know what you like, what you don't like, what segments you think are really good. We get stuff like that all the time. We don't always, hey, I like your stuff. We don't want to print those every week. But so here's Richard's take, and here's what he says. He says, hi, guys. A couple of weeks ago, the two of you covered the Apple announcement. That would be the Apple product launches. I think Sperling said it had to do with how Apple's products change the market. For that reason, I hope next week's SBS, oh, Showbiz Sandbox, will cover today's Microsoft event. Sorry, I meant to write this email before the event happened. I think it's worth covering because Microsoft's history, the bad followed by the good, has also changed the market of computing. In short, Microsoft started Surface to show how computers could be done. This did not get off to a good start and had some other issues, but then they hit a home run. Now other manufacturers, Apple, Dell, Lenovo, Google, are making devices that look like the Surface 3. And other than they announced a new Apple TV, I don't think Apple did anything special. There was not some great new service announced. Roku announced a new media player box late this week. Interesting maybe, but not a big deal. And a variation of Karen Woodward saying, company announces new hardware, big whoop. I listen to a lot of tech podcasts, says Richard, so maybe that is why I feel like the two of you don't have great discussions on tech. But maybe it would be great if you got some tech people on from time to time to talk about announcements and see if they really are game changers. For tech in general, I recommend Patrick Norton or Shannon Morris from the Tech Theme Podcast. They talk about everything. Some complex to simple, usually in easy to understand ways. On another note, Sperling, some of your jokes are funny, but often you ruin them by saying, see what I did there? In some ways, it starts to feel insulting, like you don't think we're smart enough to figure out what joke you made. I think it's more panic, buddy. I don't think that is your intent, says Richard. Besides, if you just throw in the witty and clever references and don't call them out, they will be much more clever and witty. Thanks for your time, Richard Abelow. Email sent from mail for Windows 10.
Yes.
And that's my favorite part of the email. So thanks for writing. Sperling, what do you say about his tech stuff?
Well, okay, about the tech stuff. He's absolutely right. When we cover certain tech announcements, first of all, the whole like Apple thing this time around, I had mixed feelings because I really felt like, okay, so you didn't really announce anything new with music. Okay, so that's not new. Your Apple TV, okay, it has some nice whiz bang, you know, features, and the whole like, wait, what did she say type thing, and speaking to your TV, okay, in a year, every other service and piece of hardware will do that, so that's not new. There was no game changing, business model changing, market changing service that you were announcing, and yet we all have to race to cover it because for so long that's exactly what Apple did. I would also agree with Richard that. Effectively, what Apple did here was follow in the footsteps of Microsoft with the Surface 3, the big giant tablet that the iPad Pro, which I realized they had in development for quite some time. But with the pen and the stylus, there are animators now and discussions on a lot of animation forums and boards talking about which will be better for drawing and for architecture. Because, of course, everything you draw on a piece of paper now has to be digitized. Whether it's for animation or architecture or graphic design, you then have to bring it into a computer somehow. So much like film, 35 millimeter film went to digital, the question is, do you take drawing directly to digital? And that is a big conversation now. And Apple and Microsoft have the two. And
we didn't cover that.
And Wacom also.
Maybe we should have someone on to talk about that debate.
Yeah, well, the thing is.
And who's actually used both new products. But of course, we're not tech people.
Yeah, well, I'm a tech person. That's what I do, you know, kind of.
No, I mean on the show.
Well, that is correct. That is what I would say, is that because so many others cover it, we try to cover it peripherally, and maybe we're not covering it as in-depth as we should be.
Well, I would say we want to keep it focused on what it does for the entertainment industry, and what you brought up, Sperling, is an interesting thing. I didn't know about that. So if there is a debate in the animation world, maybe we should get someone in animation who's used both products to talk about it.
Well, it's just now starting. So the debate is, well, maybe that's what's interesting about it, is that Absolutely. It's not over.
Right.
And the Surface 3 looks amazing. And, you know, Microsoft, they created their first laptop ever last week, which that in and of itself is a big, big deal. No pun intended. Patrick Norton, Shannon Morris, great, great tech podcasters. And frankly, just, you know, having listened to them for years, they are very good at explaining it. As for my jokes, he's absolutely Richard is absolutely correct. Doing that whole "see what I did there" thing.
I thought that was your tagline. That was your, you know, your go to. Hey, hey, hey. You know.
Yeah, precisely. It's what's referred to by comedians as a comedic crutch,
and it's just not a very good one.
Yes, no, actually, pointing out how bad you are at the job is probably not a good way to do it. And I know I'm guilty of it. It's
so
like,
maybe come up with a new catchphrase. That's your homework for the week.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Mayor Ed Koch. Remember him, the mayor of New York for so long.
How am I doing?
He always used to That was his crutch. He'd always do the, well, that, I guess, would be my crutch. And it's not that I'm trying to insult people thinking they won't understand it. It's more like, gee, I hope.
Flop sweat, flop sweat.
Yeah, I hope that was funny. Was it funny? So, see what I did?
Is it funny? So your homework is to come up with a new catchphrase and hopefully never use it on the show. And our reader's homework is to tell us, hey, what do you love about the show? What segments do you think are great? There should be more of. What are you happy with? What would you like to see more of? If they do that, Sperling, how would they reach out?
Or tell us what you hate about the show.
Sure.
Because we can change that too. For instance, a lot of people wrote in and said, gee, you're going through a lot of obituaries at the end. So, and we know the show is long, so we kind of said, okay, let's do the ones that we feel closest to. That helps. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to write to. DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can usually find us. And please do subscribe to the show. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us or to email or call us, or even ways to follow us. On Twitter, we're at showbizsandbox. And on Facebook, if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. Again, that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
TheSmithsBelongInTheHall.com.
Okay.
Because you know what? If they get in the hall, maybe they'll reunite and perform together. Come on, Morrissey. Don't be a... Come on, Johnny Marr. Get together one last time.
I don't think that's going to happen. But you know what? If you have trouble finding any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, try the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where some of his work is aggregated and stored and archived. Of course, bookfilter.com is one of Michael's websites. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.